You're listening to a podcast from cliftondiocese.com, the Catholic Church in the West of England, winner of 14 media awards in the past 4 years.
I'm Sister Anne Margaret, and I'm a Sister of Nazareth. I grew up in Rington, a little village. Well, it was a little village then, in those days, in North Somerset. And I started off in the village primary school, and then I went to Corpus Christi when I was old enough to travel on the bus. That was the thing in those days, and the Catholic children moved on to Corpus Christi. And I left the year that the new school was built, was opened. And then I moved on to St. Bernadette's Comprehensive in Whitchurch. And I think it was during my time at St. Bernadette's, when I was about 15, 16 or so, we started doing the Duke of Edinburgh's Award. And for the silver section, part of it was community service, and with a specific aim or kind of slant for the girls was for like mother care and child care and that kind of thing. So a couple of us started visiting Nazareth House, which was then in Stoke Bishop. I just remember it was up on a big hill, and we used to go through on a Sunday morning, Sunday kind of afternoon, which was quite a thing really, trying to get from Rington to Stoke Bishop on a Sunday where there's so few buses. And but something just kept drawing me, you know, and plus I really wanted to get my Duke of Edinburgh's Award. But we would go up and help with the babies and the small children there in the orphanage, it was called then. And I got to know the sisters, you know, quite well, and I really loved their work and what they were doing there at Nazareth House. But at that time, I certainly didn't want to become a nun. You know, it was the last thing on my mind. And when I got to my... when I finished school, we were the first group to go into the sixth form. We had a sixth form then at St. Bernadette's. But of course, now I know... I think they've made St. Brendan's. That's now the sixth form college, isn't it? But I think there were only two of us who kind of finished the sixth form at St. Bernadette's. Two girls at that time. The others were all boys. And, you know, in those days, it was either kind of teaching or nursing, really. Well, there weren't many options for the girls. And I went to teacher training college, but I really didn't feel that was, what I was called to do. I kind of didn't really feel I was meant to be a teacher. And so... it was only during the first term, really, I started volunteering again at Nazareth House and helping out with the children again. And I just, you know, kind of became more drawn to the way of life. But still, there was something in me that was rebelling all the time. I thought, no, I don't want to end up a nun. And, you know, kind of, I always thought I would just get married and stay in the village and... you know, and have a big family and live happily ever after, as they say, you know. But somehow, you know, people often say to me, what made you become a sister? And it's so true when you often hear this answer. It really is a call. And I just felt more and more that this kind of inner voice somehow, that the Lord was just calling me all the time, that he just wanted me to do this. And... in the end, you know, I really did fight against it as much as possible, and I had a great social life and went out with all my friends and, you know, had boyfriends and everything. And but it just kept coming back to me all the time. And I thought to myself, you know, if I don't at least try it or go, it'll never go away, you know. And I'm sure if I go, I probably won't last more than a few months, and it'll be clear to me that I've made a huge mistake and it won't be for me. And then I can leave and get on with my life, and you know. But that just didn't happen. I mean, I entered. Bristol and Nazareth House closed down in 1971, and the sisters asked me would I help to take some of the babies down to Plymouth. There were children were being divided up, the ones that weren't being placed back home or weren't going into foster care or adoption. A few of the older ones went to Cardiff, some went to Swansea, and then the babies, the little ones, went to Plymouth. So I had a grandmother in Totnes, you know, down in Devon, and I thought, well, why not, you know? And I was really very fond of the little ones that I'd been working with. So that's what I did. And then I think that really kind of made me more clear that this was where God was calling me. And so I went back home again for a while just to be really sure. And then I entered the sisters in Finchley. That was the postulancy in those days, up in North London. I joined the sisters there. I was a postulant there, and then I became a novice, and we had the novitiate in Hendon. And then I was made my first profession in 1974. And I was 2 years in Hammersmith in the mother house, which was very daunting after the little house in Hendon. And then I was transferred to South Africa. I went out in 76, just at the time of the Soweto riots. And, you know, it was very volatile out there. And at one time we wondered would we ever... there were two of us to come out. And we kept being warned, you know, you might not get there because there might be war. And, you know, it really was a very difficult time. But we made it. We went out. We're both still out there now. And that's the paper. And I just love my life there, you know. And I just feel so grateful that I have been, really, that I've been living in South Africa during all the turbulent times, the times of the changes, and in some small way, I hope that I have made a bit of a contribution in the changeover. I always, you know, it was the children, the babies, and especially those without families and those who really needed such care and protection. That's what drew me to the sisters in the beginning. And when I first went out, I had to help with various tasks, you know, wherever I was needed, and I hadn't really trained for anything. And then I went to the University of South Africa to do social work. I was asked to do my social work degree, which I completed. It took 6 years because it was a very heavy course, and I did it through correspondence because I still had to work and you know, help in the congregation at the same time. And then in beginning of 86, as soon as I qualified, I was transferred to Cape Town Nazareth House. I was in Pretoria to start with. And I've been in Cape Town now since 86, and with the children. And I just thank God every day that, you know, that I've had the life that I've had with the Lord and in the lives of all these children that hopefully we've made a difference for.
Sister Anne, hearing that amazing story and hearing from that very first time when you talk about this calling to become a sister. What does that calling sound like?
It's, to me, it was, it's probably different for everybody, but to me it was just a very uncomfortable feeling all the time that there's something else I should be doing, that this wasn't enough in life, and I wasn't particularly a kind of religious child or, you know, kind of a person growing up or anything, but I do like to feel that I always had a very open, normal kind of relationship with the Lord. And I suppose growing up in Rinkton, well, we didn't have a Catholic church. I mean, we just used to go to Yatton, which was a British Legion hut, and there's no Blessed Sacrament there, you know. And so it's not that I grew up in a very strong religious environment. You know, we didn't say the rosary every day. We didn't, you know, have all the extra kind of trimmings or whatever, extra devotions. Although, you know, I think as a family, we've always been a very, very committed Christian family. And I think we all have a very deep faith, but we've never spoken, you know, we don't really talk about it. But I think also, you know, like growing up in Rinkton and with the beautiful countryside around, I mean, I used to love going off for long walks. I just take the dog and I would get on my bike and, you know, just go off all during the school holidays even. And I just find myself alone with nature. And, you know, I just look around me and be so grateful. And I just felt the presence of God so strongly there. And I was just able to kind of open my heart to him just, you know, talk. And I like to think I also listened. Eventually, I know I did listen to the call. It was there all the time. I can see that now. But, yeah, it's just difficult to explain, really.
And you mentioned there that your family weren't particularly overtly Catholic, I suppose, in that sense. Mm. What was their reaction when you said you were going to join the Sisters?
Well, I think my dad, deep down, my dad was, I think he was really kind of proud. I don't like to say that word, but, you know, I think he was really, I think he really felt happy for me. And I had a very close relationship with my dad. And I think, you know, he understood me more sometimes than I understood myself, maybe. And when I got that reaction from him, I was really, I felt really comfortable. And I thought, well, you know, I think Dad understands, you know. But with my mum, I don't know whether I should say this on air, but I remember she came down to visit my grandmother when I was working in Plymouth, Nazareth House, and we went out to do some Christmas shopping. And we were on the bus, and I said to her, I'd already applied, you know, kind of written, and I said, oh, mum, you know, I think I might have something to tell you after Christmas. And she just swung round. She kind of turned to look at me on the bus, and she said, oh, don't tell me. She said, you're either pregnant or you're going to be a nun. She said, I'm sure with you there's no half measures, you know. So I thought, oh, thank you very much. That wasn't exactly what I wanted to hear, but anyway. But, you know, she just said in the next breath, she said, you know, whatever you do, you know your dad and I are fully behind you and we support you. And she said, you must just understand, as long as you really have thought very hard about it and you really fully realise, you will never have your own children. And you know, we chatted about that. And from that day on, she was so fully supportive and, you know, really happy. And I used to write to her at least every 2 weeks, and she'd write back to me. And we'd phone regularly, you know, from South Africa. I used to try and phone her regularly when she couldn't, you know, wasn't really able to use the phone very much herself. And the first thing she'd always say, how are the children? And how, you know, how are these ones? And she was so interested in them all, you know. And she really cared very much for them all. And I think she was really happy. And I've often said to her, you know, Mum, no, I didn't have my own children, but over the 24, 25 years that I've been in Cape Town, I've actually had over 1,000, because there have been over 1,000 entries. In, you know, 1,000 children have come and gone in those years. So, and as I say, if I know we do make a difference in the lives of the children, and you know, I like to think that I can be part of that, and it's so important. I mean, that some of the children come in so traumatized and totally abandoned or abused, or, you know, they're terminally ill from, because they're too far down the line for treatment for HIV. You know, they've got full-blown AIDS. Some have got terrible what would you say, physical deformities or, you know, disabilities, or that the hospital can't do any more for them and they just need TLC, or they, you know, they'll ask us to take the babies or the children that they know are not going to survive much longer, because they desperately need the cots for, or the beds for babies or children that they can help. So, and it's such a privilege for us to take those little ones, you know, that they've got nobody, they've no family, nobody at all. And you know, it's just to feel that you can just give that child that love and care, and help them to feel some kind of a sense of belonging and happiness to be in this world during the short time that they have.
Sister Anne, do you think that people here, where we are now, in England, in the West Country, know the reality of what life is like in places like South Africa?
I often think they don't. You know, I mean, look at my own family. Sometimes they'll ask me about the children, you know, about my work out there, and they're really shocked. You know, they really can't believe that certain things still happen, and or, you know, that they're going on. And I think generally, you know, we were all so excited and so thrilled with the death of apartheid and the new government, and things really seem to be starting so well. But sadly, you know, it's still a case that the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer. And the kind of impetus of the changeover and everything else is just seems to be dying down, and everybody's out for what they can get. And, you know, there's so much corruption. I mean, I know there always has been, in every country there is, to a degree, of course. But I think everyone had such great hopes and high hopes that things would improve such a lot. And I think, I know in the beginning, you know, we all used to say, well, these things take time. There's such a lot to be done. There's so much to be built up. But sadly, some of the top, you know, the top people who have got that power to do it and to spend the money in the right way, it's just going in the wrong way. And, you know, over the past couple of years, I'd say about the 3 or 4 years now that we've ourselves noticed an increase in the number of abandoned babies coming in, the number of children coming in who are suffering from malnutrition. Many of the babies are born with malnutrition because the mothers were malnourished themselves. There's such an increase in abuse cases, whether it's being reported more or whether, you know, I think it definitely seems to be on the increase. Some terrible cases of abuse coming in and, you know, neglect, deliberately neglect. And of course, in the Western Cape, we have a huge problem with fetal alcohol syndrome, which is where when the mother's pregnant, she's drinking heavily. And so the baby is born with fetal alcohol syndrome, which can be anything from fairly mild, which usually means they're, you know, can have mild mental disability. You know, they can be slow learners. They also have certain features that you can kind of see, oh, that child's got fetal alcohol, you know. And as the child gets older, they develop a lot of behaviour problems, which unfortunately often ends up in the gang culture. And so many of the gangsters and the gangs we have in the Western Cape, which is a huge problem, they're all suffering from fetal alcohol syndrome. But it can vary, as I say, from mild cases to very severe. And we've got some very, very profoundly disabled, deaf, blind, very physically disabled children who it's just purely the fetal alcohol that has caused it, you know. And many of those children are HIV positive as well. And it's, you know, you look at them and you just think, you know, if they just had the HIV and they were on treatment, they could lead, you know, as healthy and good a life as anybody else. Because, you know, happily now with the antiretroviral treatment, AIDS has become more of a manageable condition. But, you know, when you see the effects of the fetal alcohol syndrome and you know it's avoidable, it's so avoidable. So we have huge programs going around the schools and the churches and youth groups trying to, you know, help the youngsters to see the effects if they start drinking, you know. And of course, they've got more chance of getting pregnant when they are drunk as well. And it's just a vicious cycle repeating itself all the time. They can have heart problems, very, very bad heart defects. They get a lot of infections because of their low immune system. It's, you know, people think, oh, it doesn't matter, I can just drink a few extra, you know, but they don't realise what harm it's doing to the unborn baby.
Sister Anne, what about the perception of the work of the Catholic Church in Africa, it's specifically in your case in South Africa? Do you think the wider world knows what the Catholic Church is doing in Africa? Do you think the wider Catholic Church knows what their brothers and sisters are doing in that particular continent?
Well, I can't really say because I'm not over here very much, but I would think probably not. Because, you know, I mean, I have to say that really the Catholic Church in South Africa has really been in the forefront in the fight against HIV and AIDS. As far as care and treatment. And you know, we've tried the prevention programs and we don't give up. We're still trying with the prevention programs in the schools and the youth groups. We've got some wonderful Catholic groups. I know the Salesians, they've got wonderful programs. There's Life Choices and Love Matters. And it's all an education for life. That's another one. And in fact, they've been invited into many of the high schools, the non-Catholic high schools in the Western Cape. around, because this program is really fantastic. And they really draw, you know, it's being run by young people. They're drawing the young people. And but in the case of care and poverty alleviation, and yeah, I think general welfare, I think the Catholic Church is doing, really, I must say, it's doing a fantastic job in South Africa. And we have an AIDS desk at the Catholic Bishops Conference. We have a Dominican sister who's running that. And each diocese has to have an AIDS office, or, you know, and then we try and claim help from the AIDS desk, the central AIDS desk. They get some kind of donations and funding from different international AIDS organizations. And so there's a very strict regime on distributing. Obviously you've got to have results, and you must show what you're doing, and you know, and there's regular inspections and everything. And I think that transparency helps a lot too, you know, because even though you think, oh no, not another report to fill in, and not another statistics, you know, more statistics and everything, and I hate doing that, but at the deep down, you're so thankful that this is being done, because there is so much corruption and so much, you know, so many other organizations have had their funding taken away because there's been fraud and embezzlement, and you know, so but yeah, I think really the Catholic Church can hold its head high as far as that goes, the care and the pushing forward, you know, and I would really like, you know, Catholics over here to know that, because, you know, we're all one big family and we're all one big church, and we all have to help each other. And if we have the prayer and the support of our fellow Catholics in kind of more advantaged countries, in other countries, then it all helps to give that mutual concern and compassion and support and everything.
Sister Anne, you've been back home in North Somerset for a little while. You'll be heading back to South Africa very soon indeed, imminently. Mm. What will you be doing when you return back? What's your day-to-day activities? What's the first thing you'll do when you get back there?
Well, the first thing I do, I'll go and see all the children. I'm managing the children's home and place of safety there in Cape Town. And so, you know, I'll be back with my community at Nazareth House in Cape Town. And we've two cottages on the premises for the children. One is for our older disabled special needs children, mostly girls, and most of them we've had since they were babies. Our oldest one is 19 now. She has very low grade Down syndrome. She can't speak, but she came in as a newborn baby straight from the maternity hospital after she was abandoned. And then the youngest one, I was on the phone the other day to our superior. They've just got a little two-day-old baby came in the other day. So that may be the youngest one when I get back. But, you know, so it just never stops. And then that's in the one cottage, we've got the disabled special needs girls. And the other cottage is our emergency place of safety. And that's 24 hours a day. Mostly at night, you know, the police will contact me, or the child protection officer who's got my 24-hour phone number. So I might get a call 2 o'clock in the morning. Could happen the night I get back, I don't know. You know, and maybe they've found an abandoned baby, or the police have been called to an abusive situation, or there's some child in distress. So we have to quickly get ready and admit the child, bring the baby in. Sometimes, especially like over holiday periods, Christmas, Easter, you know, and kind of those times, we're so full up, but we're actually the only after hours place of safety for small children in the area. So we just have to put mattresses down or make sure we've got an extra little corner somewhere. And we try and move them on as quickly as possible. If they're healthy, and then we find there's a granny in the Eastern Cape that's got the older siblings, and, you know, it maybe just take a few weeks to get the reports back from the social worker there and arrange for the child to go. Maybe the child got lost in the supermarket or wherever in the big shopping mall, and or the mother left the child at the creche and had an accident on the way home, sadly, or something like that. And so those kind of cases are very easily solved. And so we do try and move the healthy ones that are able to be moved on like that as quickly as possible. So we've always got room, you know, for another crisis. But sadly, we do get a number of cases that we can't move on. Some of the children are so malnourished or so frail, some of the babies. You know, we've got a couple of little one-year-olds at the moment. One weighs 3.5 kilograms. You know, that's like 7 pounds, like a newborn baby. And those kind of little ones that come in like that, we usually have to keep them for a year or two. And then we work very closely with the local hospital, and they put the children on a nutrition program. And some of the children come in very sick, and then by the time we've kind of helped to get them over that, then we discover they're HIV positive. So then they have to get put on treatment. And it's very, very difficult to get foster families for the HIV positive children. There's still so much stigma and fear. You know, so that's always a problem. But we always do what we can to try and place the child in a more family-like, you know, even if it's a small foster family where there are only six children as opposed to a larger group. So we you know, the children's home should always be a very last resort for any child. And so we do move on as many as we can, you know, hopefully to much better, longer-term care.
Finally, Sister Anne, yourself, you're here back home in North Somerset, where a few miles from where you grew up, where you were a child.
Oh, I love it.
And you're heading back to South Africa just in a few more days. Mm. Will there come a time when you come back to here and live permanently, or will you always have your life in South Africa?
Well, that's something only the Lord can answer that. I really don't know. People often ask me that. Even my sisters, you know, my brother, they say, oh, do you think you'll come back to stay here? When are you going to come back for good, you know? And I just can't say that. I mean, I never dreamt I would end up there. It's funny because I'm one of five children, and of all of us, I was the only one that used to say from the very beginning, well, I don't care where you go, you can go to France. You know, they were all going off on holiday when they got to be, you know, got older. I say, you can go to wherever, go to Europe, go and have your holidays or wherever you go. But I'm staying in this village. I'm going to live in this village. I'm going to die in this village. And when I die, I want to be buried under the, you know, and under the tree in the churchyard. And they laughed at me. But now I'm the only one that's not living here, living, you know, because I've got a sister in Clevedon, one in Nailsea, one here in Kongsbury, and my brother is the furthest away, and he's only in Burnham-on-Sea. So when you ask me that question, I can't tell you. I really don't know. I just leave it in the Lord's hands.
Let Us Pod from cliftondiocese.com, reflecting the life of the Catholic Church in the West of England. Winner of 14 media awards in the past 4 years. cliftondiocese.com, updated every day with your stories and your views. Make sure you're part of it. Email letuspod@cliftondiocese.com.